Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Joining us today is David Shild, the Executive Director of the Printed Circuit Board Association of America, the voice of America's printed circuit board industry, while the United States has focused an unprecedented degree of investment in making high-end computer chips, and there's clearly been some progress since the last time David joined us. The printed circuit board is a critical element and indeed represents about 70% of the microelectronics supply chain that also requires investment in as nations, as the United States and commercial industry worldwide have increasingly relied not only on foreign semiconductors, but also foreign printed circuit boards. David, thanks so very much again for joining us. It's always a pleasure having you on the program.
Thanks, Vago. Great to be here.
Indeed, a pleasure. And a quick word from our sponsors, the Defense and Aerospace Report and its family of publications is brought to you by HII, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, GE Aerospace, Bell, Leonardo DRS, American Rheinmetall, and TE Connectivity. David, it's been a little while since you joined us. A lot of enthusiasm about what the 2024 budget number was going to be, right? A night, you know, you got what you asked for, whereas 2025, not looking so good. Walk us through the legislative achievements that you guys and your supporters up on the Hill have made. I know that you guys also have supporters across the administration as the administration has focused on building up that supply chain. But sort of what happened in 25 funding that is giving you a gap? Walk us through where we are right now, or
yeah,
where you
so
guys are now.
Let's start with sort of the victory that I would say that we won on March 9th, right? Of course, we had this lag and this departure from regular order, and we didn't see the government appropriations bills move forward and essentially keep the government open until late into the first quarter of this year. But what did come through in the FY24 defense appropriations bill was a very healthy number for the DPAP or Defense Production Act purchase account. There was this big split in the Senate, right, in the House. We thought, okay, we're either going to land around $431 million or $618 million. There's a huge delta there. In partnership with our friends at IPC, there was a concerted lobbying effort. Many CEOs of microelectronics companies, substrate companies, raw materials companies, board companies coming together to say, look, this is the account through which the Pentagon invests in next generation microelectronics. It's one of the five key technology pillars that have been identified by folks like Dr. Laura Taylor Calais. It's one of the things that's mentioned repeatedly in the National Defense Industrial Strategy, right? The first ever one that came out this year. And where we landed was $587 million in that DPA account. And a very important piece of language that I'm going to quote from here because it's a little bit unique that this kind of language would be in, but it's directed to make sure that the Pentagon and Congress are aligned on priorities. And it says, it's noted that printed circuit boards are key components of advanced defense technologies and that a strong domestic defense industrial base includes the ability to fabricate printed circuit boards. It's understood that the Department of Defense intends to use the Defense Production Act purchase account to address domestic industrial base shortfalls for printed circuit boards in fiscal year 24, the Secretary of Defense is encouraged to prioritize DPA investments in support of domestic PCB fabrication. That language, along with this $587 million, and of course a subset of that is for microelectronics, is so important because it doesn't just say, here's the money. It says where to spend it.
Okay, so what is a longer-term plan here need to look like, right? It seems like we really thought through one side of it, the semiconductor side of it, and that's picking up speed. And I'm going to ask you a little bit about that. But what's the approach we need for the rest of, right? I mean, as you said, the packaging, the boards, and all of the other things that go with it, you can't have one without having the other.
No, there's a whole microelectronics ecosystem here. Sometimes it's referred to as the technology stack. And the pithy way that we say it is chips don't float. Semiconductors got a $52
billion.
You know
what? It's always a good one. I'm sorry. It's corny, but it works. Well done.
Well, it works. And I, you know, it was coined out of the Pentagon. I can't claim credit for that phrase, but it's very true because when you look at this $52 billion investment infusion, underwriting, whatever you want to call it, that is the Chips and Science Act, right? It took us 5 years to get that piece of legislation through. We had some of the biggest companies in the world behind it. And what we end up with are these very, very high-tech fabs in places like Columbus, Ohio, in places like Chandler, Arizona. And what we're trying to tackle is the stated problem that America only makes 13% of the world's semiconductors. I can tell you that America only now makes 4% of the world's printed circuit boards and less than 1% of the world's integrated circuit substrates. So we have had a similar contraction, a similar slide offshore, primarily to Asian markets. 56% of the world's supply of PCBs comes from mainland China alone. The Japanese pretty much own and dominate the IC substrate market. And we don't think that foreign dependency on adversaries or allies, quite frankly, is healthy. So what's next, Vago, to answer your question, is what would naturally follow the CHIPS Act? You've built one part of the stack. You've made an investment that's paying off. Ground is being broken. Semiconductor companies like Intel and TSMC are receiving their share of CHIPS awards. Now we need the rest of the ecosystem. And that's just not substrates and boards. That's raw materials, right? That's copper and laminate and prepreg and all of these technologies that turn into circuit boards, which are much more complicated than simply green pieces of plastic. The analogy that I use is the American auto industry. And when we had final assembly of vehicles in Detroit, we had brake pads coming from Illinois and transmissions coming from Ohio, and we had wiper blades coming from Indiana, and we had a manufacturing ecosystem. Secretary Raimondo sometimes refers to these as manufacturing nodes. I think the administration sees the vision here. They're just moving out on the first part of this investment, which is chips.
When you look at, again, what a long-term strategy looks like, what does the long-term strategy need to look like? And no bucks, no Buck Rogers, David, right? So, I mean, at the end of the day, you need, right, for, you know, talk a little bit about the sustained investment and what you get for $200 million, what you get for $500 million, right? I mean, you guys have metrics on this. Walk us through what an investment plan looks like, because we're being very specific. And indeed, you know, we've put a lot of money with a lot of different places to start up the chip side of this equation without really as much of a concerted plan, right? As important as it is, as you just made the case, how much money and what does that money buy you?
Absolutely. You know, there's really two vehicles right now that we envision as being most beneficial for our industry. And let's start with the Department of Defense, right? Because the Pentagon has long recognized that microelectronics make all of our smart weapons smart. It makes all of modern, you know, warfighting basically possible. And so for our national security, as well as our economic security, we got to make microelectronics here in America. And we do that very well now. We meet the Department of Defense's needs, but the commercial side of the defense house is not strong and the surge capacity is not there. So the DPAP account puts money on the table. In the last year, you've seen awards to companies like Calumet, like GreenSource. It only totals around $90 million, Vago, which, you know, is not a significant investment against what we need to be doing. It needs to be in the hundreds of millions, if not the billions. But I'm encouraged that the Pentagon is starting to spend those funds. You got to keep the account funded. You got to use directed language to tell them where to spend it. And then you actually have to get these awards out the door. That's obviously where we have concerns about FY25. But I'll stop for a second and just say there needs to be, on the commercial side and more generally outside of the Defense Department, funding as well. The CHIPS Act, of course, while it does shunt some money into Pentagon coffers, is primarily administered by the Department of Commerce. Secretary Raimondo has pushed billions of dollars out the door. I think the expectation is it'll take up to a decade to get that money fully deployed. We have a similar bill in the House, the PCBs, or Protecting Circuit Boards and Substrates Act, which would run a CHIPS-like program at the Commerce Department, direct grant money to the tune of $3 billion, and a demand-side tax credit that says if you buy American-made printed circuit boards or substrates, you get a 25% tax credit. That's what we need to get private capital off the sidelines. And you hear this number tossed out a lot, but I think it bears repeating. The $52 billion that the CHIPS Act has generated has brought, by some estimates, as much as $460 billion in private money off the sidelines. Wall Street follows government on this. And so what we want is for people to look at a new PCB factory the way they're currently looking at a new semiconductor factory as a good investment, because the government has decided this is part of industrial policy.
So how does this work, David, as we build up the chip manufacturing capability, as you said, right? I mean, there's an awful lot of money going in, and companies are now beginning to talk to us about where the, you know, roughly when the outputs will be coming out of this system. What's at stake when there is a gap between the chip manufacturer, right? So good news, in a couple of years, we're going to be getting there. Downside, you don't really have an evolved printed circuit board industry to go with it.
Sure. I think we're going to be confronted with some tough realities. We're not trying to undo a global economy, but I don't think that the administration or the congressional vision of the CHIPS Act is that things made in Arizona, Ohio, New York, and Texas have to transit the Pacific to turn into the things that make modern life possible. There is definitely a future in which we can have a percentage of the market sourced, if not entirely domestically, primarily sourced domestically. And so we can be making integrated circuit substrates, printed circuit boards. We can be assembling those boards, testing them, moving them on to OEMs. We can be doing that all domestically. And what it's really a great insurance policy against, Vago, is supply chain disruptions. You don't have to do anything but turn on the news and realize that whether it's man-made or natural, there are severe threats to our supply chain. We woke up during the COVID-19 pandemic and realized that we were dependent on Asian markets for a lot of the things that we rely on every day. But boy, oh boy, you know, from what we've seen in the Red Sea to what we've seen in the Port of Baltimore, there are any number of reasons to think that having foreign stretched out global supply chains shouldn't be the norm. It should be part of a diverse manufacturing portfolio.
I've asked you this question, given that I'm recording this from the sidelines of the Navy League's annual Sierra Space Conference and Trade Show, obviously AUKUS, the Australia-US-UK technology agreement and submarine agreement, right? Pillar one is submarines. Pillar two is everything from hypersonics to quantum to AI, you name it. And now it appears that with Japanese Prime Minister Kishida's visit to the United States, that's likely to be expanded to include Japan becoming potentially an AUKUS Pillar 2 partner on that sort of broader technology. What's the role of allies and partners in this? Where can we share? What can we, who can we depend on until we stand up our own industrial capabilities? Because obviously the biggest worry is, you know, a nefarious actor could install stuff on these, right? You may have the best chips, but unfortunately, because of the ecosystem they're attached to, they may be somewhat less than secure. What's the way to navigate this through, David, especially if, frankly, I mean, people are not taking this issue as seriously, clearly, as they ought to be taking it, right? Ultimately, what's the way to do this with allies and partners? Either in the meantime or right. going beyond the meantime.
You know, I think that we have to take a view that is global. And I've said this before, we are not trying to undo the global economy that we built over the last 40 years. In building that economy, we did build dependency. In some places, we built it stretching into adversaries. So that, I think, is not what we need to dismantle, but what we need to rebalance. And I'm glad you mentioned the threat and the concern about sourcing critical technologies in adversary nations. It's something that Al Schaefer, who's the former Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition and Sustainment, and I, we wrote about this recently for the Lexington Institute, which is we absolutely need to be concerned that this is a threat vector, that this is a place of concern. I know the Pentagon is concerned about it. And that's one of the reasons, again, it's in the National Defense Industrial Strategy. It's in the NDAA. You consistently see offices being stood up to deal with supply chain and sourcing issues. I think the future, Vago, definitely involves allies and partners. And of course, we talk all the time to folks in Canada, in Mexico, in the Dominican Republic, in any number of locations about where work can be done. Certainly, you see a lot of work moving to places like Malaysia, the Philippines, Japan, and Taiwan are already very strong in this area. But again, 89% of the world's printed circuit boards coming out of Asia, 56% of the world's supply coming out of mainland China. That is dependency, any way you slice it. And a rebalancing there, I think, would make everybody sleep a little better at night. And when I talk to the heads of supply chain and the heads of purchasing at the big OEMs, they say, we want to do more work in the States and with allies, but the costs don't support it. I can't make the bottom line work. That's where federal policy comes in. That's where a tax credit, that's where grant money makes a difference. And I'm going to say one other thing about this, which is we're simply playing catch up, Vago, on industrial policy. Other governments have already been doing this. And in some cases, they've been doing it for 40 or 50 years. They provided the seed money for some of these companies to launch. They provide subsidized worker housing. They give you the land. They build the roads. So this argument that the government is somehow getting involved in a way that our foreign competitors are not, I just don't find that credible, because for many years, nations have engaged in industrial policy to own and control the markets that they see as critically important. We're finally starting to view the world through that lens here in the United States.
And look, there's a question I want to ask you about that, right? Because it's hard for me ever to say that I completely agree with the way the Chinese are necessarily doing things. But again, they're making a strategic investment and are reaping the benefits of that strategic investment. We're trying to do this through a more market-friendly way with basically, you know, priming the pump, for lack of a better phrase. But before we get to that, what is the cost delta, right, between the chips that are available and the printed circuit boards as well that are made, for example, in China, and what it is in the United States, given that we have sort of a, I don't want to use the term stunted, certainly with the august executive director of an important organization, but we have a stunted American industry in part because everybody was buying from abroad and we just have a handful of manufacturers to satisfy specifically the highest of high-end weapon demands. And even then we were often letting foreign printed circuit boards into our defense ecosystems when maybe we shouldn't have, in the name of false economies, right? But what is that cost delta, especially when you're trying to be in a competitive, in a commercially competitive setting?
Right. So there's really two ways to answer this question. You know, the first is to say that for very high-end defense applications, the U.S. retains the technical capability to do it, and under ITAR has the exclusive rights to generate it. So we don't have a good cost comparison, obviously, on a lot of the defense products because they have to be made here at home. I would say, much like military engines, for example, when the commercial side of the house is healthy, the defense side of the house is healthier, right? So keep that in mind when I talk about ITAR and defense-specific products. Regarding commercial products, it's really on a case-by-case basis. And I'll use something like a thermostat or a garage door opener as an example of a mass-produced, at-scale, foreign microelectronic. It's going to be very difficult to bring those sorts of technologies that have essentially been commoditized back home. But let's think about the printed circuit board that can be made well abroad and can be made well at home, but its end use is medical devices, or its end use is banking servers, or its end use is critical infrastructure like the power grid or the electrification of the American economy through windmills and EV chargers and solar panels. I would argue there's a strategic reason to put in place a tax credit that brings you into a cost competitive position. Maybe it's not parity, but if you get close, now you can say the combination of the cost competitiveness and the strategic reasons not to source abroad, those make it compelling to buy in the U.S. I don't think, again, we're ever going to see garage door opener microelectronics come back to the United States of America. But I don't think we want to have a dependency where what keeps the lights on, what keeps the water flowing, what keeps commerce running on Wall Street depends on foreign sourcing. I don't think that's healthy for any number of reasons.
Well, obviously, we are having this discussion in part because of the CHIPS Act and all the investment we've seen and we are seeing. I know that you're not the voice of the semiconductor industry, but you watch them pretty closely because you're
sure,
commingled and important ecosystems. What are, from your standpoint, right? I mean, what's the progress we've seen? It's probably been about 2 months since we've had you on. What kind of progress have we seen just in that last 2 months or so? Because the needle, I think, is in some ways moving maybe a little bit more slowly than people thought, whereas actually in a lot of other ways, you know, as you said, I mean, almost now $500 billion in capital has flooded into this space on a $52 billion investment. What are some of the more interesting developments from your standpoint as an observer?
Sure. So I think it's first, the private capital thing is really miraculous, and it just shows why we need to have industrial policy in this country. I would say, Vago, that the CHIPS money being awarded now in billions and not in tens or hundreds of millions is a very positive step. Intel's most recent award to build a large-scale fab in Chandler, Arizona, is perhaps the most prominent example of that. And again, my estimate and the estimate of many others is that it will probably take close to a decade to get all this money out the door. The government's being deliberative on purpose, and I can't second guess them for that. These are taxpayer funds. After all, they should be careful. If you talk about the challenges in building some of these technologies, you know, 2, 4, 6, 8 nanometer semiconductors, they're very real. And I haven't heard an adequate discussion yet on the workforce challenge. Putting up bricks and mortar is one thing. Staffing a building full of electrical engineers and computer scientists and well-qualified folks is another challenge entirely. And it may be that the workforce challenge is something that we haven't solved for. Our industry faces it as much as the semiconductor folks do. My hat's off to the CHIPS office. I think they have kept this sold very effectively. Of course, there was a lot of congressional debate and that bill ballooned and then shrunk and then was in danger of not passing, but it got over the goal line. The money is getting deployed. The factories are being built as we speak. The test, of course, will be, does what come out, what emerges from those factories, is it competitive on a global stage, and does it create a sustainable economy in those parts of the country, right? Is it this really, is this manufacturing resurgence that we're seeing, and all the numbers coming out of the Fed and out of Wall Street seem to agree that there is a reshoring initiative going on, that manufacturing is coming back to America. Is that going to stick? Is it going to be sustainable? My view is that it's the gut job of the executive branch and the legislature here to keep their foot on the gas. That's why you hear things like CHIPS 2.0 being talked about. That's why we're trying to advance our legislation. The worst thing we could do now, I think, Vago, is pat ourselves on the back and say, we did it. We solved the problem of high-tech manufacturing in America with the CHIPS Act, and let's move on to the next shiny object. No other government on the planet took a 5 or 10 year view of this. Certainly the Chinese didn't. Certainly the Taiwanese didn't. They got to the position that they are in now because of decades of work and, by some estimates, hundreds of billions of dollars. So we need to play the long game and take the long view. I can appreciate the challenges politically. You know, it's an election year, of course, but I think that's what we need to do to make this a success.
If you look at it, right, I mean, and my point about not necessarily being pro-Chinese, but the Chinese regarded climate as a market, invested heavily, you could argue stole technology as well, which never should be permissible nor the case. But alas, they've also been investing and developing and become a technology developer and, you know, a nation that's managed to advance battery technologies. You know, we're crying foul in some of these things, but I'm sure if I'm sitting in Beijing, I'm like, I don't know what you're complaining about. I'm the one who invested in it and you didn't. That's your problem. It's not my problem, right? Ultimately, now, because China is the center for a lot of this production, whether it's on the energy efficiency side of things, again, which depends on very successful, very sophisticated microelectronics as well as software. What happens if there's a broader rift, David, between the United States and China, right? Janet Yellen was just in Beijing, making the case, you know, whatever you do, don't sell stuff to the Russians to help the Russian war effort. And the day she leaves, you know, day after she leaves, Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, is in Beijing, pictured meeting with Xi Jinping, right? I mean, and the Chinese already are helping the Russians. It's kind of a two-part question. First, I mean, does it make sense for the United States to be criticizing Chinese state investment in this when the United States really is the one who developed this capability through, in part, state investment? And the second thing is, if we've got to sanction them or things between Washington and Beijing get really, really bad, well, what happens if we're depending on a lot of Chinese microelectronics and a lot of the things that we do?
Sure. Let me start with the first part of that, which is, I think every nation around the world now is looking at being competitive on industrial policy, right? The U.S. CHIPS Act has been followed by multiple acts that have come out of European governments. You have seen the Chinese step up and do their own additional investment. There's going to be a competition now because microelectronics, semiconductors, substrates, boards, certainly their use in everything you can imagine, right? Whether it's AI, whether it's medical devices, certainly in defense technology, right? We say everything from F-150s to F-35s relies on this tech. People see that the future economies of the world are dependent on this, and they understand that they must act accordingly. I'm not going to criticize any government for acting on industrial policy. What I'm going to do is look at my own government and say, are we being competitive in a world marketplace? Are we taking a long view, a sustained view? We can't control geopolitically what's going to happen, and I'm going to refrain from commenting on the interactions of heads of state. What I am going to say is if you are not now looking at your risk portfolio, if you are not now trying to mitigate against supply chain disruptions for any reason, man-made or natural, in the next 5 months or in the next 50 years, I don't think you're being a responsible business leader or a responsible government official. We can act and we can create a scenario where there is no dependency that risks jobs or our national security, but we have to act and we have to act now.
Couldn't agree with you more, David, and certainly wish the very best for your efforts, and we'll help you continue to try to tell the story, because, you know, absent taking a strategic view of this, it is very problematic if the United States is going to be able to satisfy not just its commercial, but certainly its national security needs. So thank you very much. Best of luck on it. By the way, who's the champion of this, right? I mean, is there... Right. There were a lot of folks who were very proud about pushing forward the semiconductor part of it. Who are the champions on the printed circuit board side that are trying to advance the ball?
Sure. In the House, our bill is co-led and initially sponsored by Representative Anna Eshoo from California and Representative Blake Moore from Utah, both of which understand the economic and national security implications. We're hoping to have a Senate companion bill this year, and I'm very encouraged by the actions of folks like Senator Shaheen, Senator Schumer, Senator Peters, and Senator Young. A number of folks who led on the CHIPS bill see that more work needs to be done. They see the jobs implications, the national security implications for their home states, and I think they're taking a strategic view. So hopefully the next time we talk, we'll be able to talk about the Senate bill and the co-sponsors and the champions on that side. And we continue to add House co-sponsors every month. I don't think there's a domestic opposition or adversary for this issue. It's simply a matter of educating first, advocating second, and legislating third. And I can't begrudge elected officials who maybe are not incredibly familiar with how microelectronics work. That's our job. That's why PCBAA was created, to teach them about the importance of the stack and what we need to do next.
And real quick, in less than 30 seconds, you guys have been growing. Talk to us a little bit about the membership and how you're expanding it.
Sure.
And how people can get involved.
Thank you. 3 years ago, we had 5 founding members. We just passed over 57 today. If you are anywhere in the microelectronics ecosystem, raw and refined materials, board and substrate manufacturers, assemblers, test, OEM, we want to talk to you about getting on our team. We're working very hard for policies that will move your bottom line and your markets in Washington, D.C., PCBAA.org. And of course, contact me at any time on any social media channels, because we think that we represent the interests of hundreds of organizations, and we know that will increase our political power in Washington. The bigger we get, the bigger the impact we can have.
Best of luck. Thanks so very much for joining us. We look forward to having you on regularly with updates. Thanks again.
Thank you, Vago.
And thanks to all of you for joining us. We appreciate it very much. We'll be back again tomorrow with the Air Power Podcast with my co-host, JJ Gertler, and sponsored by GE Aerospace. Thanks very much again. We'll see you again tomorrow. Until then, have a great day.